Hello, and welcome to another installment of Red Handed Does an Interview. This time, we are speaking to author extraordinaire Claire McGowan. You might be familiar with Claire's works. She's predominantly actually a fiction writer. But in this particular interview, we spoke to Claire about her first foray into the world of true crime writing and her most recent Audible exclusive on the Vanishing Triangle in Ireland. If you would like to watch the full video of this interview, you can do so right now over on patreon.com/redhanded. On that note, if you haven't yet subscribed to the brand new Red Handed YouTube, follow the link in the episode description below. Go over and subscribe. Once we hit 20,000 subscribers over there, we're going to start regularly posting videos over there too. But for now, you can watch this over on Patreon, or you can listen to the audio exactly as you are doing right now. So enjoy.
Well, welcome, Claire McGowan.
Hi.
To our Red Handed interview series. We're extremely happy to have you here. And you have just, are you calling it a book, or are you calling it an audiobook, an Audible project? What's the right terminology?
I guess audiobook, but I suppose, I don't quite understand the difference between an audiobook and a podcast, I suppose, in real terms. So, it was commissioned as an audiobook, and we've been calling it that.
Okay, cool. And what was it about creating an audiobook rather than a book that originally attracted you?
It wasn't really my idea. It was more just an opportunity that came up because, as you probably know, audio content has massively grown in popularity over the last few years. I think it's gone up by 40% or something like that. So Audible were just looking for more true crime projects after West Cork was such a success for them.
Oh, of course. Huge. Yeah.
Which was a brilliant podcast. I absolutely loved it.
And Irish as well. So we should probably tell the listeners what your audiobook is about. It's about the Vanishing Triangle. Some people refer to it as the Dublin Vanishing Triangle. Is that something you agree with, or do you keep it with
Well, it is around Dublin. Yeah, I've never heard it called that specifically. But so it is a sort of a rough triangle around Dublin. Yeah.
In which this sort of vague triangle shape, 8 women went missing in Ireland between 1993 and 1998.
Yeah, at least 8, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How many do you possibly think there are?
Well, I found quite a lot of other cases that maybe weren't quite in the same area, but we're talking about Ireland, it's a very small country, so it would take no more than a few hours really to get to these other places. So I would be so wary of restricting it necessarily just to this sort of triangle because it's a bit arbitrary.
Sure.
And there were also quite a lot of murders right before or during the same time of women that I thought potentially might be connected. So actually the West Cork case was actually also in this time. It was in 96, I believe, although almost certainly not connected. But just goes to show there was a lot of things happening at the time.
Absolutely. And we've obviously touched very briefly there about what the audiobook is about, but Claire, could you give us and everyone else listening at home just a very quick breakdown? We obviously don't want to give away any spoilers or give away too much about it, but if you could give us just a quick breakdown or a run through of The Vanishing Triangle, your new audiobook, tell us a bit about it and why people should go listen to it.
It looks at those cases, as you say, of the women that went missing over that period of 5 years, at least 8 women from a relatively small area around Dublin. But it goes a little bit further as well and also looks at some cases of some murders that happened in the same area a few years before. So I go back to 1979 because there was a murder then of a woman in the same area that I thought was possibly connected. And then I look at some other cases as well in other parts of Ireland that possibly might be involved. But I've looked at it sort of quite thematically. So I knew I wouldn't be able to solve the case because they're not murders as they are in Serial or West Cork, where we have a suspect and lots of evidence. There's no evidence at all. None of the women have ever been found. So very little to work with. So instead, what I tried to do was kind of examine possibly why these might have happened, these disappearances, and also why are they still unsolved all these years later? Why is there absolutely no evidence and no leads?
Yeah.
So I look at things like, so the political situation in Ireland, just the police not having the technology they do nowadays, like DNA and CCTV and things like that. There's lots of other causes. It's a little bit of a snapshot of what Ireland was like during that key period of the mid-90s when it was going through massive amounts of change.
Absolutely. And it kind of, like you said, it's very, very difficult because it's not
an isolated case. It's not even a series of murders that have occurred that you can try and link the evidence together or anything like that. It reminds me a bit of a case that we did on Red Handed, a few weeks ago now, which was on the vanishing women of Juarez in Mexico. So just hundreds, thousands, no one even knows how many really women have gone missing. And I think the difficulty that all of the journalists who've tried to approach that case is similar to what you describe with this story of there's just not enough evidence, there's not enough leads, there's not enough to grasp and pull these together. But something that we obviously need to be talking about because something is happening.
Yeah, so, unless you find a body, there's really very little that you can do. People could be potentially could be still alive, although it seems very unlikely in these cases.
And you're not new to this game. You're a fairly prolific author under your own name and also your pen name, Eve Woods. How do you choose a pen name? I've always wondered.
Yeah, everyone always asks me that. It was actually my great grandmother's name, who was Irish. So it's really not a very Irish name at all, but she was Irish. I had to do my family tree in primary school once, and I thought it was a really lovely name. And I thought at the time all authors had pen names, and I thought, well, that would be my pen name. And then of course I ended up using my own name to start with, and then when I had to have a pen name, that was
what came. Well, it is a lovely name, you're right.
I think so, yeah. There's no one else in the family called that or anything, so it's unusual.
And this is your first work of non-fiction, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So what was it about The Vanishing Triangle in particular that you were like, this one is my first non-fiction work?
Well, as I say, the opportunity to write it just kind of came up. It wasn't something I particularly sought out to do. But when I was asked, are there any unsolved crimes that you can think of? And that was the first one that came to mind, just because when I heard about it, it really kind of shocked me that there were so many cases and no one really knows about it. I think outside of Ireland, it's not hardly known at all. But just that it was still unsolved as well. And it was kind of this suggestion that maybe there was a serial killer in Ireland and nobody had even really noticed. That was quite shocking.
Absolutely. And like we said at the start, we don't want to sort of pigeonhole it to being only 8 women, because it could have been far more than that. We don't know. But roughly, I guess we would say between 93 and 98, at least 8 women seem to have gone missing.
What I discovered, I do go into in the book, is that probably 3 or 4 of those, if you delve into it, it seems like they actually were killed by people they knew.
Wow. Okay.
To me, that was an interesting story as well. It was like, well, why are we so keen to believe, oh my God, serial killer? When if you look at it, it's more, the causes are kind of closer to home and less sensationalist. It's things like domestic violence.
Yeah.
Why was it not possible to convict? So whilst I do believe there was someone out there as well that was abducting women, I don't necessarily believe all these women were victims of that person.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point to make, because I think it's something we come across in the world of true crime quite a lot, is that we're all very scared of stranger danger, the serial killer that's going to jump out of the bushes and attack us, when in reality, most people who are killed are killed in their home by people that they know. And I think that there's something so much more scary about that than the stranger attack, because not only is it incredibly rare, but this is people that you know. And you're right, there is that hesitance to talk about domestic violence and familial murder. We're much more comfortable as a species, as like a community within true crime, to talk about people who are just going to be from the other. And I wonder if it is that easier to otherize them, isn't it, than to talk
I think it's just not as sensational, is it? It's like, of course, there's no mystery. It's like, it's that really obvious person, the person that had beat this woman up before and broken her jaw, for example, is them.
Exactly.
And I noticed that Women's Aid Ireland had started to catalogue every murder of women from the kind of the 90s onwards. And it was something like over 80% of it was by people they knew. And it was nearly always partners, or it was quite often their sons, actually, which really surprised me as well. I think a surprising number of women are killed by their grown-up sons.
Oh my gosh. That is horrendous. And you're right. I think while it's not as sensational, it is so horrific. And like I said, so much more scary, it seems to me. And the statistics you say, I'm not surprised at all that it's about 80%, because that's pretty much what you would see generally in the murder world. But was there, Claire, for you? Because obviously there were at least 8 women. Like you said, some of them may have just gone missing. Some of them may have been murdered by their partners, for example. what was it that led you into the Vanishing Triangle? Was there a specific case that you first picked up on? How did you develop an interest in this?
So I wrote a series of novels that were set in Ireland and in the present day, or what was then the present day, so about 10 years ago. And in the process of researching that, it was about a missing persons unit. Because I've always been really fascinated by missing persons, just because you don't even know whether it's a crime or not. And you kind of tend to assume, particularly when it's a young woman, they've been abducted, they've been murdered, but that might not be the case. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that's why I find it more fascinating. And I just came across these cases in the course of research for that and kind of filed it away. I was quite surprised I hadn't heard about it at the time in the 90s. Because I was in my teens then, and I was very tuned into the news because I grew up in Northern Ireland, so we all were.
And you mentioned earlier that the audiobook is sort of a snapshot of Ireland at the time, and Irish history is not something that is particularly prevalent in English and Welsh schools. I'm sure you're aware of Scottish schools also. Could you give us a little bit of a rundown in a very short way of the big changes that are happening in the mid 90s in Ireland that are that could have hindered the investigation possibly?
Just in terms of social changes. So for a start, I grew up in Northern Ireland and the Troubles were still raging. There were quite a few different ceasefires during that time that broke down and leading up to, so between 93 and 98, when the peace process kicked in and we signed the Good Friday Agreement, there were a lot of things happened. I actually looked it up recently, and at one stage there was like every single day someone was being murdered or something was happening. There'd be a shooting, there'd be a bombing every single day. So no wonder there wasn't a lot. And actually there is still a lot happening in Northern Ireland even now. Like somebody just last week, somebody put a bomb under a prison officer's car, a woman prison officer with a small child. They tried to firebomb her car. Luckily it didn't work, but it was a viable device. So that happens, it's still happening, and it happened then even more. And then in Southern Ireland, which is where these cases took place, and I lived on the border, so not far from there. So for example, I had things like 92 was when they legalized contraception. 93 was when they legalized homosexuality. 97 was when they legalized divorce. So all these things that happened decades before in the rest of the UK were only happening then in Ireland. As you probably know, abortion was only legalized 2 years ago. So and only in March in Northern Ireland, I believe. Yeah. So I believe last month in Northern Ireland, it only started being offered. So in one of the cases, for example, one of the women had an abortion a few weeks before she disappeared. She'd gone to England for it because she'd had no other choice. And the Gardaí, the Irish police force, had leaked that to the media that she'd done this. So they kind of said, well, look, this is what happened to her a few weeks ago. She was depressed. And her family was saying, no, she wasn't depressed at all. You know, this was just something that happened to her, but she was okay. So it's that kind of thing, I suppose, the societal attitudes that might have affected the way the women were seen.
And you mentioned there, like, obviously, all of the various things around the legalisation of homosexuality, contraception, abortion, divorce. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about Irish cases, you can't get away from the sort of religious backdrop against which a lot of these crimes unfold. And you mentioned there sort of the societal impacts that may have hindered this investigation. Do you think there was an element, Claire, at the time in Ireland about, you know, maybe sexually motivated murders and attacks don't really happen in Ireland because of the religious, the religious backdrop under which these cases may have been unfolding? Do you think that affected the approach that investigators took to it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was maybe more that they just didn't think it could happen in Ireland. I think because Ireland is so small, and they kind of saw it as a friendly, welcoming country, where they thought that if there was going to be a murder, it would be politically motivated, even in Southern Ireland. But just as another example, like I'm sure you've heard of the Magdalen laundries, the kind of mother and baby homes, that the last one of those closed in 96. So there was one in the town I grew up in, there was one until the late 80s. So.
Wow.
My mum was a doctor. She remembered that she used to have to go and work there occasionally when she first moved to the town. So very recent, but definitely a few of the families said they suggested to the police at the time, could my sister or my daughter have been abducted by a stranger? And the police were very down on that idea. One of them actually did say, no, that doesn't happen here.
So that's an attitude I've come across quite a lot of, like, this. There's something about Ireland in like a it just doesn't really happen here type of way. And I also think there's a lot of like British colonial guilt of like not just not acknowledging anything at all within the education system.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely does. I discovered loads of cases where people have been killed by strangers, though.
It's an interesting narrative to just like to overall believe when it's the facts are there that it does happen and it is true, but there is this belief which seems quite bizarre. So you've mentioned earlier on that people were quick to sort of jump to a serial killer. Do you think there's any indication at all that even a few of the disappearances could be linked to a singular person, or do you think they're separate?
I think they are, yeah. I don't think there's no evidence, unfortunately, but if you look at the way some of them disappeared, so one of the women, for example, she was only 18, she was a student who'd gone home for the summer, and she was walking home from town in the middle of the day. So it was about 3 o'clock in the summer, so it was obviously bright. Quite a few people saw her along the road, and somebody saw her pretty much at her gate, the gate of her house, and she disappeared. So what else could have happened to her except that someone drove up and pulled her into the car? And there were a few other women that disappeared either while sort of traveling home at night or walking along the road alone and things like that.
In all of the stories that you've collected to make the audiobook, is there one woman in particular, one story that you've really identified with?
I suppose that one, because it was so baffling that she went missing so close to her house in the middle of the day, and also she was quite similar in age to me, so that would have been in 98, she was 18, I was 16. And then there was another case of a girl who was just 17 when she went missing, and that was really close to where I grew up. It was just the other side of the border, and we would have gone to some of the same discos and things, that girl and I, and she was 17, I would have been 15 at that point. But I never heard that she'd gone missing, never heard anything about it at the time.
Gosh. And it sounds like you're so close to some of these cases. I mean, just literally the fact that you maybe would have been in the same age bracket growing up near some of these victims. How did you go about doing the research? Because one thing Hannah and I do, obviously, on the show every week, we do the research for the show, but we do it all very much through secondary sources. We've never said that, we're not an investigative podcast. We are a storytelling podcast. But how, Claire, did you go about doing the research for this? Were you like boots on the ground? Were you talking to people who have been involved in this? How did that look? What did that look like?
Yeah, so a bit of both. So I don't have any kind of investigative or journalistic background either. So I didn't really feel comfortable kind of ringing up the families. And in many cases, the families, the parents of the person have passed away, sadly, or the main family member who kind of took on the investigation has passed away. So it was mostly archival. I did a lot of research in the papers at the time. I did speak to some of the detectives that were involved as well. So a little bit of both, I suppose. And then I did some kind of background research talking to different organizations.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we often get when we speak to people on this show who have, made documentaries or made films or written books about a specific case in particular, there's often this kind of unifying thread of people saying, there was this point at which I felt like I was in too deep. There was a point where I felt scared, or I had a particularly unsettling experience with somebody I was speaking to. Was there such a point, Claire, for you that just maybe just sent a bit of a tingle up your spine, that maybe made the hairs on the back of your neck stand up? Was there anything like that that happened?
I think it was when there was a kind of chief suspect in some of the cases who you can very easily find. It's quite openly talked about, but obviously there's absolutely no proof whatsoever. And this person has always denied any involvement, but certainly has a history of violence and attempted murder. When I found out that this man lives in London now, so he went to prison for a while for another crime, for rape, and he got out after 10 years because at the time Ireland didn't have a sex offenders register, so he didn't have to sign anything, so he's free to live wherever he wants. He's lived in Europe, but now he lives in London. So I guess that was kind of playing in my mind a little bit, because I live in London and I live on my own. And around about the same time the book was about to come out, we had the Sarah Everard case in London, which was just had so many parallels with the stories in the book that I found that quite chilling and very sad, that the same kind of things were being said about her, like why did she walk home at night and so on, which is really depressing because people were saying that about the women in my stories, even though in some cases that was the middle of the day. And that was, you know,
that's almost entirely depressing.
Yeah, right. That's almost 30 years ago, and people are still saying the same things now.
Yeah, so, yeah. I think that's one of the things, whether we're dealing with cases that are historical, whether we're talking about 70s, 80s, or whether we're talking about the case of Sarah Everard on the show, the narrative that people like to throw at these cases hasn't changed.
I think people just like to think, well, oh my God, that happened to her. Could that happen to me? Oh no, she must have done something that put herself in danger. Therefore, I would never do that. Therefore, I'll be okay. And unfortunately, it just doesn't work that way. As we've seen, most women that are murdered by people in their own homes. So.
Exactly, exactly. Wow, that is terrifying. And the especially the bit about the man living in London now. I assume you talk about him in the book, and that's why you were scared.
Yeah.
Is it Harry Murphy?
Yeah, so yeah, I'm always a bit worried about like naming him because there's no proof that he's connected to
him. No, but we did, in the time when we could do live shows, we had... Mm-hmm. People come over from Ireland to our London show, and they specifically were talking, we did like a Q&A, and they were like, are you guys going to do Larry Murphy?
Yeah.
So he
was convicted. He was caught basically murdering a woman in 2000, early 2001. And he'd taken her off the street. He took her from a car park about 6 o'clock in the evening, just sort of really like lightning fast attack, got her into his car in less than a minute, drove off and raped her multiple times, took her up to the woods, took her into exactly the same area that these disappearances took place, up into the mountains, and then he put a bag over her head and he was strangling her when he was interrupted. So that's all proven. He was convicted of all of that, but he got out in 2010. So
and there is always, I feel, have you found, like, especially with the Vanishing Triangle specifically, there being so many different cases of so many different women in so many different circumstances, that because everybody knows about Larry Murphy, they're like, oh, it must have been him, and that takes the heat off literally everybody else.
Well, the thing is, I actually found there were quite a few suspects. So there was another man who, the murder I mentioned in 1979, that wasn't solved for 20 years, and it was only solved because at the time, this really prescient Garda, police officer, he kept the blood sample from this man. So they had interviewed him, he was a suspect, he had an alibi, and at the time there was no facility for doing anything more than just a blood test. Mm-hmm. So this guy just locked it away for 20 years, and when DNA became available in the mid-90s, wasn't available in Ireland for a long time after that. They had to send the samples to England, and there wasn't the budget. There was a whole argument over the budget, so it almost didn't get done. And when they sent the samples, it was very obviously this man, and it turned out the person that had given him an alibi had lied for him. So he definitely murdered that woman in 79. He was free for 20 years. You know, what are the chances that he never did anything after that?
Yeah, like slim to absolutely, absolutely zero. So that is terrifying. I think we on this show absolutely applaud anybody who goes into the world of like writing journalistically about one specific case. It's not something we've ever done on the show. It's something we'd love to do. So full respect to you for that, Claire. And I know that this is a case that interests a lot of our audience. I don't know if Hannah actually mentions before I joined the call today, but we have like such a strong Irish following. It's okay. Amazing. And it's just really, really nice to see. I think the last time we looked at our numbers, we have the same number of people listening in Dublin as we do in London, which is crazy considering the population difference.
I've spoken to a few documentary companies since the book came out who are trying to work on programs about these cases. So I think we'll probably see a lot more about it now, not necessarily because of my book, but I think there's a growing interest in it. It's always been quite well known in Ireland, although as I say, I didn't know about them in the 90s at all.
Wow, that is remarkable.
Possibly because I grew up in Northern Ireland, but it was really not very far at all. So the town, that girl I mentioned before that disappeared from the nearby town, that's like 20 miles from where I grew up. So
wow, and to not have heard about that is unbelievable. And the reason I said we have so many Irish followers because we have had so many requests to cover this on Red-Handed, but we just couldn't make it happen because we're like, in an hour-long episode we can't, because there are so many cases, there are too many suspects,
so many names. I had to actually take a few cases out of the book in the edits just because it was just so many different
murders
and disappearances and so on.
So I think that's probably the biggest difference between what is achievable on a podcast versus what is achievable on an audiobook. So guys, we're so sorry to everybody who's ever requested us to cover The Vanishing Triangle. It's just too difficult. But Claire has done it for us. So if you are interested in The Vanishing Triangle, which you absolutely should be, go check out Claire McGowan's book, The Vanishing Triangle, which is an Audible, original Audible exclusive. So you can go check it out there and listen to the whole thing. And we'll leave some links below and stuff for it. But guys, this is the internet. You know how to find it. So yeah, anything else, Claire, you would like to tell the lovely people who listen to Red Handed?
Yeah, I suppose just to bear in mind that these things are quite rare, even though, as yes. I said, they were not as rare as I thought they were in Ireland, not by a long chalk, but I would never, so I live in London, I have done for years, and I never feel unsafe here. Mm-hmm. And I really would not want to start. So I just do my best to remind myself that, you know, it's very unlikely.
What an important message to end on, I
think. Exactly. And now you've hopped from book to audiobook. What's next for Claire McGowan? What have you got in the pipeline?
So still working on my thrillers. I have another one coming out in October. And I actually, a friend, this complete sort of pivot, my friend and I wrote a kind of parody of Pride and Prejudice on social media, which we have sold as a book, and that's going to be coming out later in the year as well. So that also, I guess, well, it's not non-fiction, but it's been... It's not fiction, but very fun to write. It's very good palate cleanser after this one.
Yeah, absolutely. I bet. Yes, we're very familiar with those brain scrubbing steel wool moments.
Definitely. Yes. And actually, I know, sorry, before we let you go, I'm just really interested. Would you, I know you obviously said palate cleanser after this world of true crime and nonfiction first bag at it. Would you do again? Would you do another true crime book?
I would, yeah. It was huge amounts of work. Probably just because I was a bit unsure of what I was doing and had a lot of imposter syndrome. I would love to maybe team up with someone, so maybe someone that does like to do investigative work. Nice. Because that's not really my thing. I'm more the kind of writing and the thinking and the structuring.
Sure.
So that could be really interesting. But yeah, definitely love to write some more nonfiction in general.
Perfect. Well, we will stay tuned for all of that, and you guys should too. I also just saw The Vanishing Triangle is over 5.5 hours long. That's why we can't do it. That's why Claire's done it. Go listen to that. Yeah. And thank you again, Claire, so much for taking time.
Thanks for having me.
To us.
It's been great.
Lovely. Thank you so much. All right. Yeah. So yeah, everybody, this is just another one of our Red Handed interview series. We'll keep you, we may have a very interesting one coming up soon, but we're not going to spoil it yet because we don't know what's happening with it. Stay tuned for more of these, and we'll see you all in our next whatever it is from Red Handed. Goodbye.